Good morning. Well, we were expecting a terrifying budget, our fifth austerity budget, but the Coalition's third and final one under the Troika before we exit the bailout. Shortly after 2:30 on Wednesday afternoon, Ministers Noonan and Howland stood up in the Dáil and unveiled a package of cuts and tax rises totalling €2.5 billion. Many of the measures had been leaked in advance, but as ever, the devil was in the detail, and there were angry exchanges in the Dáil with Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald and Micheál Martin accusing the government of attacking the old and the young.
The only thing that your budget achieved yesterday is to take 32 million out of the pockets of people under 25 on job seekers who want to work, who can't find work. But you didn't stop at that. You've cut funding to third level education. You've whacked up the registration fee for third level students again. You've taken money from young people on FOS courses. You've hit apprentices now and insist that they pay a registration fee. So please spare me your waffle and your baloney about your concern for our young people. I tell you what you have incentivised. You have made it clear to people now, to our young people, that it's time to pack their bags, it's time to leave, because this government has failed them, will fail them, sees them as a burden.
Young graduates confined to the dole queues, but because we reform the system, they get an opportunity to go into the world of work. And I might say to you that over 65% of those who go on a job bridge scheme find full employment as a consequence. And if you think that's a Mickey Mouse operation, then go and speak to those young people. How dare you insult their intelligence?
Thank you.
How dare you insult their motivation? How dare you insult their right? Their right. Sinn Féin antics of wanting to confine our young people to dole queues in perpetuity. Give them taxpayers' money, give them tax and confine them to the dole queues.
Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin accused the government of the big lie by claiming older people hadn't been affected. The Taoiseach described his comments as opportunistic blather.
From the abolition of the telephone allowance, Taoiseach, which is unacceptable in terms of what it will do to older people. The withdrawal, definite withdrawal, of 35,000 medical cards from people over 70. And then that wider witch hunt of another 100,000 cards that will be taken from people. And Taoiseach, it started already. The letters are being issued so savings can take effect from January. Anyone listening to Joe Duffy Liveline during the week would have had those letters read out that are going out withdrawing cards from people. The fivefold increase in prescription charges over the last 2 years is going to hit older people significantly.
Thank you.
The doubling of property tax will hit older people. The reducing of tax relief on health insurance and the abolition of the bereavement grant, all targeted against older people. You add it all up, Taoiseach, and it represents a very savage attack and targeting of older people in our community. And the question I have for you, Taoiseach, why? Why in this particular budget did you single out older people for particular targeting and discriminatory treatment? What did the older people of Ireland ever do to you to deserve this kind of treatment?
On the traditional post-budget phone-in, Sean O'Rourke put this very point to Finance Minister Michael Noonan.
Would it be fair to describe this as the budget in which you finally caught up with the older members of the population, whether it was reducing the threshold for people over 70 to qualify for a medical card, taking away the last of the phone allowance, the bereavement grant is gone, other measures like that, the higher dirt charges. Back to the old Brian Lenihan mantra, everybody has to pay something, and this is when your nerve back about dealing with older people.
No, I wouldn't say that, because we're protecting the older generation because we appreciate the contribution they have made to the country. We didn't touch pensions, either contributory or non-contributory pensions, at the same next week as they were last.
Did you even think about that? You surely didn't.
No, of course we didn't, no. But more importantly, we didn't touch income tax credits for the elderly, which are very enhanced. And if you take, for example, a couple of pensioners living together, man and wife, husband and wife, they pay no tax until their income passes 36,000. And we have single people going on to the 41% rate of tax just above that level. So the benefits in the tax law for elderly couples are totally preserved.
And it was during that post-budget phone-in that the hard cases emerged. Stella recently lost her medical card.
I have twin boys, both of whom have lost their medical card in the last month.
Now, both of them have cerebral palsy. One is quadriplegic, that is, he's without the use of his arms or his legs. The other has autism and mild cerebral palsy with an intellectual disability. They both require 24-hour care and they're both in nappies. Now, can you tell me where the signal is there that you cherish my children as equally as the under fives when I have to struggle and go on air to look for the medical card for them?
Everybody would listen, you know, with anguish to what you say. I mean, to look after your children is your absolute priority. We have no policy to cut discretionary cards. That is the clear decision of government. And you should not lose a discretionary medical card unless you're well in excess of the guidelines. And we can look at any individual case, such as your own. What we're doing here in terms of the budget announcement yesterday is asking for the Department of Health and the HSE to ensure that medical cards are received by those who really need them, people like yourself.
But the medical card controversy continued across the airwaves all week on Liveline and on The Late Debate with Audrey Carvel. On the gathering yesterday, RTE's George Lee gave his take on Budget 2014.
You can't take the amount of money out of the economy that they're taking without people really feeling it. And like Michael was saying, there was a kind of impression that this wouldn't be such a bad budget beforehand. I was quite struck by the extent to which we were almost prepared for a giveaway budget, because the Fine Gael conference was on the weekend before and it sounded like it was going to be, well, they were all very excited about how far they had gotten getting out of the programme and so on. It sounded like this budget was going to be fantastic, but I think they left take-home pay alone for most people, but you don't take money out of an economy without everybody else beginning to feel it elsewhere, and then they begin to think it's sneaky because it isn't up front. It's in the likes of the medical cards, it's in the likes, like you cut CIE's funding and the next thing fares go up, and so we pay. You put a levy on banks, we pay. And that's what people will be upset about.
Michael McGrath is, and it's reported today and in the Dáil yesterday, putting out a statement saying the budget small print actually refers to a total package of 3.1 billion rather than the reported 2.5.
Yeah. The total package in terms of the budget, because there were other savings in there which adds up. You can be pretty sure that there's no funny stuff in terms of the big numbers because the Troika is all over it, the EU is all over it, the IMF is all over it, so you'd expect the numbers to hold up. But it still is taking that much money out of the economy, the 3.1 billion, compared to what we would have had. If they didn't actually, Sean, have the promissory note deal, they would not be able to deliver even this budget. The growth figure which they're going for now is much lower than where we would have expected even 2 years ago for next year. They expected that in April, when they came out after the promissory note deal, they said that they'd have a surplus at this budget, a primary surplus of 1 billion. That's not there anymore. And the growth figure is much lower. So we're really taking a bit of a gamble in terms of the overall adjustment to the economy as well.
George Lee, and no doubt more budget analysis from George, who'll be here after the 10 o'clock news with the business. Well, one man who seemed oblivious to the worries of the budget was drugs criminal John Gilligan. He walked free from Portlaoise prison on Tuesday morning, having served 17 years behind bars. Nicola Tallant, investigations editor of the Sunday World, was outside the prison.
And shortly before 10 o'clock, a grey Mondeo car with John Gilligan's brother Thomas in it pulled into the prison and they waited outside, and Gilligan emerged, smiling, bag in his hand, into the car, and they pulled out of the prison extremely quickly. He managed to look out of the back passenger window and give a good big smile, the usual smug grin for the media. He hasn't changed at all. I mean, it's hard to imagine, so many years have gone by since certainly I and others saw him in the Special Criminal Court when he was convicted.
John Gilligan was driven to his brother's house in West Dublin, where family and friends had organised a welcome home party with balloons and streamers and beer. He spoke with journalists, including Michael O'Toole of The Star, insisting he had no involvement in the murder of journalist Veronica Guerin.
I had nothing to do with Veronica Guerin's murder. Miss Guerin, Lord Messner, she never wrote one word about me. You know, nothing.
Do you accept you assaulted her?
Pardon?
Do you accept you assaulted?
No, I didn't.
I didn't.
And I seen people said I admitted this. I didn't know such thing. And another thing is, the reason why I didn't get convicted to Special Criminal Court at the murder, when people said I threatened the lady in an oven, we asked, at them days, there was no throwaway phones them days. Mm. They were all phones, bill phones to your landline. And the court said for 5 days, they asked the prosecution, please produce a bill form to here, and we'll know where these threats came from. If he was a Roman, if he was in Ireland, or if he was in another jurisdiction, and the prosecution didn't produce any because there was no, because I never made any phone calls.
So you didn't threaten to rape the young fella or anything?
No, we didn't. No, George Woodson, not a chance in a million years.
And you didn't, when, did she call to your house?
I've not been decent enough, respectful enough, I didn't duck and dive. I could have come out of prison and hid. I won't be hiding from nobody. I've no problem with anybody.
Just tell us what your plans are.
My plans are going to have another beer.
Only one member of John Gilligan's drug gang, Brian Meehan, was convicted of the murder of Veronica Guerin, as Paul Reynolds told Áine Lawler on Wednesday's News at One.
John Gilligan repeating in public what he's always said in public there, that he had nothing to do with the murder of Veronica Guerin, Paul, and insisting that he is an innocent man.
Yeah, I think it would be a surprise if he had said anything else. He has stuck to this line from the very, very start. And obviously, you know, it's in his own interest to stick to that line. I mean, the reality of the fact was that the DPP felt that there was sufficient evidence to charge him with the murder. There were accomplice witnesses who gave evidence against John Gilligan, both Charles Bowden and Russell Warren, who both went into the witness protection programme. Now, the Special Criminal Court found that that evidence couldn't be corroborated, and therefore John Gilligan was acquitted of the murder. But it's very interesting to hear him speak there about the claim that he didn't assault Veronica Guerin or he didn't threaten her son, because again, that seems to be another version where he's rewriting history. I mean, that's contrary to the evidence. Obviously, he wasn't convicted of that, but the reason why he wasn't convicted is because the primary prosecution witness against him had been shot dead on the Naas Road in June of 1996. There were photographs taken of Veronica after the assault, and they were published in the Sunday Independent subsequently. And Veronica also gave a very detailed statement to the Gardaí, and she was prepared to give evidence against him in court. In relation to the threat as well that he addresses there, in relation to the threat to rape her son, that was dealt with during the murder trial, and an eminent senior counsel, Felix McEnroy, gave evidence in the witness stand of the Special Criminal Court. And he said that he was there when John Gilligan threatened not only Veronica, but also threatened to sexually assault her son. He said he recognised John Gilligan. He recognised his voice because he had acted for him 6 years before. And he said that Veronica Guerin was sitting in his office at the time taking legal advice following John Gilligan's assault on her. Her phone rang. She powered up the volume. Mr. McEnroy said that he walked around from behind her desk and heard two loud, abusive voices. He didn't recognise the first one, but he did recognise the second one as that of John Gilligan. He heard Gilligan identify himself on the phone, and he told Veronica Guerin that he would kidnap her son and sexually abuse him and that he would shoot her. Now, that was the evidence that was given by Felix McEnroy during the murder trial. Now, as we know, John Gilligan was acquitted of the murder, and the issue of the threat of sexual assault against her son was never pursued by the Director of Public Prosecutions.
As Paul Reynolds mentioned, Veronica Guerin was shot dead on the 26th of June 1996. She was returning from Naas Courthouse, where she was up on a speeding charge. A motorcyclist pulled up alongside her car at a traffic light. The pillion passenger fired 6 shots into her car, hitting her in the upper body. On Today with Sean O'Rourke, we heard how her husband, Graeme Turley, had explained to their 6-year-old son, Cathal, that his mother wouldn't be coming home.
So I said, Cathal, do you remember the last time Mum was shot? Well, it's after happening again. And he said, yeah. And he said, where was she shot this time? And I said, she was shot in the heart. They hit Mum 3 times around the heart, and they hit her in the neck. And there's 2 bullets still in the car somewhere, they think. We're not exactly sure. And he said, is Mum coming home? And I said, no, she's not coming home, but she's going to be here minding us. Because remember, we talked about this before. Oh, I got it, he says. She's with God now, and she'll be looking down on me and everything I do from now on.
The shocking death of a woman journalist gunned down in broad daylight in the line of duty caused huge revulsion and an outpouring of public anger. Her murder was a turning point. The criminal fraternity was thrown into disarray and the Dáil reconvened to pass new measures. The Criminal Assets Bureau was set up, new prison places were promised, and the constitution was changed to tighten the bail laws. One of Veronica's closest friends was Irish independent political reporter Lise Hand. She spoke with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday.
Veronica Guerin was a very close friend of yours. How did you meet her first?
Well, we met in the Sunday Independent. We were both working there at the time and I was a little bit in awe. She would come in like a whirlwind, dash over to the news desk, have a quick chat, wave around two mobile phones and then run out again because she really hated being in the office. She was a great woman for working out of her car, for being out and about. But we got chatting a few times and we bonded over a mutual love of Manchester United. She was absolutely fanatical, much more so than I. And we got to the extent where we used to travel over for games together and we just, again, she was a great woman for a chat and a gossip and we would spend absolutely hours on the phone just having chats about the office and about work and so on. And it was just her sense of humour and her absolute joie de vivre. She was irresistible to be around. She really was.
A great sense of daring as well. I think you told a story once about how she was on a plane going over to a match and she didn't have a ticket and then something happened.
She didn't have a ticket for the match and a colleague she knew from the Independent took sick on the plane and was been taken off and she essentially went over and relieved this poor stricken soul of his ticket as he was been taken off the flight saying, you know, you won't need this then, will you? And, you know, she absolutely loved travelling for games and certainly we had enormous fun together. There was one particular occasion I remember with great fondness where I managed to obtain two passes for the Players' Lounge. Now, Veronica, for all the years she'd been over there, had never been inside the Players' Lounge, which was the holy grail for any fan. So when the final whistle went, we went in. She ran around like a child, getting her photograph taken with everybody. She even, I think, tried to rob the Man of the Match award. At one stage, I found her trying to slip it into her handbag. Actually, probably the only time I saw Veronica lost for words was when the door opened and her and my great hero, Eric Cantona, walked in. I offered to take a photograph and she was literally lost for words, which if anyone who knew her, that was a very rare occasion. So I took a wonderful photograph of her. Now, sadly, that photograph actually ended up sitting on her coffin on the day of her funeral. But we just had so much fun together. She was great to be around.
And Lee's hand recalled that terrible day her friend was shot dead.
Tell me about the 26th of June, 1996. She went to a court in Naas in County Kildare. It was a simple traffic offence. It was something she was fairly accustomed to.
Oh, yes. She was no stranger to the old speeding offence. I think she could have papered the house with the speeding tickets. She was summoned before yet a judge. And she was genuinely terrified they were going to put her off the road because her car was her office. She sped here and there and everywhere. And she frequently broke the speeding rate. Anyway, she went down and much to her enormous relief. And miraculously, she was let off with a scolding and a fine. And she called the news desk on the way back up and she asked to be put through to me. It was coming up to 1 o'clock. We had a quick chat and she was absolutely thrilled. We laughed about the fact she got off. She was coming into the office for a meeting to do actually with the impending court case on the assault. I was meeting a friend for lunch, so we arranged to meet for a late coffee. So I went off, turned off my phone because I was meeting somebody for lunch, and on my way back to the office, it was an extraordinary thing. I was coming up Henry Street and I was turning into the GPO arcade to go in the back door of Independent Newspapers, and there was a newsstand there and I saw a crowd around it and I was struck by this. I thought, my God, has war been declared? I had never seen this, a crowd actually gathered around a newsstand. So I went up to have a look to see what the news was, and the late edition of the Evening Herald was there and it just had Veronica Guerin shot dead written on it.
This is the woman you were speaking to an hour earlier.
Yes, I talked to her less than 10 minutes before she was killed, maybe five. And I was actually hurrying back to meet for coffee. So I suppose I flatly refused to believe it. I just went into complete denial. And I remember walking through the second floor of the Daily newsroom and it all seemed quite normal. And I had convinced myself by the time I got into the Sunday Independent, that it was a mistake. So I walked in and just every head turned to me and I realised that, yes, in fact, she obviously was gone. And the newsroom was strangely quiet for a while, and then suddenly all the phones just exploded. And as the news started to spread, it was extraordinary. I mean, obviously, I was personally devastated, but everybody was in shock. And the next few days, I've never seen anything like the outpouring of grief. I mean, I'm sure you remember as well. It was the subject everybody of the airwaves. Her funeral was a huge event. There was, you know, the President of Ireland was there, the Taoiseach, half the cabinet. There were flowers. I remember walking up to Leinster House and there was just a sea of flowers against the railings of Leinster House. And the anger of the public, it was really, this has happened. Please do something. We are not taking this anymore. Do something. Please do something.
How will you remember her generally?
Well, I remember her as just this woman with vast spirit and great courage.
and a sense of humour, and that anyone who met her, their lives were better for it. I mean, she just was somebody who just made you feel better being around. She was extraordinary. And she was motivated really out of the purest of reasons. She really wanted to make people's lives different. She was special. She was one of a kind.
Journalist Lise Hand remembering her friend Veronica Guerin. She was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Tuesday.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Former SDLP deputy leader Seamus Mallon is no stranger to violence and death. Alongside John Hume, he worked tirelessly to bring about peace in Northern Ireland during the darkest days of the Troubles, and he was a key player in bringing about the Good Friday Agreement 15 years ago. He believes the peace process ended up marginalising the moderates like the SDLP and the official unionists by bringing Sinn Féin and the DUP centre stage. Seamus recalled those days in an interview with Marion Finucane last Saturday. He was in Dublin to receive an honorary doctorate from DCU.
Tony Blair had the image, well, we all knew about his conversion and that kind of thing. What was he like? What were your dealings with him like?
I was Blair's greatest fan when he was the shadow spokesman in Home Affairs. I thought he was tremendous at the dispatch box in the House of Commons. Great on television, a great speechmaker, nice guy, until he came to the crunch. He had a moral stance on everything, as he told us. And yet, when it came to decisions, there was very little morality in some of the decisions. And I look at the ones, what happened here. I look at what happened in Iraq. And I sat on the seats, the Labour, the benches in Westminster on the famous day when he made a speech to the House of Commons going to war. And I turned to one of my colleagues and I said, "Do you believe this?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Are you going to vote for it?" And he said, "I have to." So from then on, I lost the respect I had for him. And I must say, the way in which he has peddled his influence around the world, especially in the Middle East, has decreased that even further.
Well, say, during all the negotiations coming up to the Good Friday Agreement, did you still respect him and like him then?
I was wary of him because it has been obvious for some time that there was a switch, that rather than a policy approach which had been there for quite some time, that you built from the middle out and did it in a way that you got the extremes in and that you had inclusivity that included everybody, not just the extremes. You could see that changing. And you could see also the drive from two governments, especially, and others, to get an agreement. This became the imperative. The handshake and the photograph.
Yeah.
And the good story coming out became more important than what was being discussed in the negotiations.
Because to us outsiders, it looked like both himself and Bertie Ahern showed a dedication that was second to none.
Well, of course they did, and they spent the hours and they spent the time. But as I said, that decision in terms of the middle ground was a fault line in the agreement.
Did you ever take him up on it?
Oh, I've been saying it for years, and I said it
to him, I mean.
Oh, yes, I've been saying it to them at that time. And making the point, look, yes, we go ahead. Yes, we get violence stopped. Yes, we get Sinn Féin and DUP in. Yes, we do that. But we don't sacrifice that which kept the political process going, that which kept the north of Ireland out of a civil war over 30 years. You don't sacrifice that in doing that. And there was a way of doing it.
And Seamus Mallon was equally scathing about Gerry Adams.
As you look at Gerry Adams and you look at Martin McGuinness, who's in your role now, and you saw Martin McGuinness running for the presidency down here, what's your perspective on them now? Are you mates with them?
No. I have a difficulty because every time I see Gerry Adams, I think of a lady called Jean McConville. I always remember her body was found, or her bones were found on the Cooley Strand, and it came to identification, and her daughter, who was then a grown woman, identified her because she had a cardigan, a Fair Isle cardigan, part of which was still there. And she was asked, "How do you know that's your mother's?" She said, "It is. It's the only one she had." And there's that poor woman killed by the IRA. And when I look at Gerry Adams and listen to what others in his own organisation said about that incident, it's very hard to not to have the image of Jean McConville floating about in the back of your head while you're looking and listening to the very reasonable Mr. Adams as of now.
These days, Seamus Mallon cares for his beloved wife, Gertrude, who's suffering from dementia.
My wife had a dementia, still has. I was faced with a choice. When John Hume decided he couldn't go any further, I had a choice to make. I'd love to have gone on and lead the party. I knew what changes I needed. But then I had to say to myself, you know, where's my responsibility here? And I made my choice. I believe I made the right choice.
Well, obviously you're caring for your wife. How is she?
It's dementia. She's 24 hours a day care. We're caring for her at home. It's her wish and mine. So that you have, that's your priority. My second priority is to walk my dog. And my third priority is to look after my garden. And after that, I read quite a bit and follow the whole political process, not just here, but elsewhere.
Mm.
And look carefully at the things in your experience that you might have done better or might not have done at all. And it's quite remarkable when you get into that type of private soul searching, some of the things that you're right about, but some of the things that you got slightly wrong.
Dr. Seamus Mallon, who was in conversation with Marion Finucane last Saturday. But there have been positive changes from the piece. On Thursday, Northern Ireland's First Minister Peter Robinson gave the keynote address in Belfast to mark the GAA's contribution to peace building. Des Cahill spoke with former Armagh footballer Jarlath Burns on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
It was massive significance, I suppose, down through the years, the GAA and unionism would have had, let's say, a touchy relationship. But maybe we would have felt that unionism didn't fully understand exactly what the mission of the GAA was in local communities and how it was a non-violent way of professing people's identity, Irish identity, and just what it did for communities. And to hear all of the leaders of unionism gathering there last night and so many other public figures and figures from business and everything else, under the watchful gaze of the great bridge builder herself, Mary Nicolise, whose portrait hangs in that hall, and Seamus Heaney as well. It was just a night full of symbolism and full of massive significance, really, for everybody involved.
And what was the content of Peter Robinson's speech, Charlotte?
He acknowledged, firstly, the GAA's role in bridge building. He spoke, firstly, about the decision to remove Rule 21, which banned members of the British security forces, and specifically the PSNI, from playing our games. And then he went on to actually praise the kind-heartedness with which the GAA embraced the deletion of the rule, right up to the point where there was actually an advertisement for PSNI recruitment in this year's All-Ireland programme.
From yesterday's Morning Ireland. Well, PJ Mara is another blast from our political past. He was government press secretary to Charlie Haughey for many years. Both men are in the news this week because a three-part TV series on Haughey's life has just started filming in Dublin. Well, we all know it's not PJ's first taste of the limelight. Who could forget his starring role in the RTE satirical radio series Scrap Saturday? But this time round, he'll be played by actor Tom Vaughan Lawler, better known as Nidge from Love Hate. Miriam O'Callaghan spoke with PJ on Wednesday.
Now listen, what do you think of the series being made on Charlie?
What amazes me about it is that it's 22 years since Charlie was Taoiseach and I was press secretary to myself and the government. So it's extraordinary that the interest and the fascination has lasted almost a quarter of a century.
And it has. I mean, the enduring mystique. Why do you think he remains of such interest to people?
There are politicians that capture the public imagination. All kinds of myths and stories grow up around them. The one thing about it, I suppose, about Charlie Haughey was that to the very end, like, he had a huge amount of popular support. I mean, he was getting, you know, in the 40s market share of the vote. And obviously that says something about him, and I think that fascination has sustained itself.
Are you hoping the series will do justice to him? Because whatever else, he was never boring.
Well, that's for sure. I hope it does do him justice, because as you say, he was multifaceted. You know, he had his faults, which everybody knows about, but he had huge strengths, and I hope that those strengths are brought out in equally with the fault finding.
You've said the new TV series should keep the middle classes happy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that goes back. You know, I was asked years ago about Scrap Saturday and, you know, what I thought about that. And I said I was, you know, always pleased, you know, with something that kept the Irish middle classes happy in their beds on Saturday mornings. I hope that this series will keep them happy, maybe not necessarily in their beds, but it'll keep them happy anyway, whatever night it goes out. And it will be interesting and it will be good viewing.
Will you watch it?
Of course I'll watch it, yeah. I mean, I'm vain enough to, you know, if Tom Vaughan Lawler is, you know, playing my part, I mean, you know, he's... now has almost as big a reputation as Charlie Hoy had in his time. That in itself is probably pander to my ego.
Are you happy that he's playing you?
I think he's a fine actor and he's a nice guy and I'm sure he'll do a good job.
PJ Mara with Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday. Well, the Wexford Opera is one of the glitziest events in the cultural calendar. The festival opens next week, powered by over 250 volunteers. A.B. Philbin Bowman spoke with some of them for Tuesday night's Arena. Jane O'Faherty discussed the popular prejudices about opera.
I'm in college now and even trying to explain it to third level students who are struggling with other things. They just think it's so highbrow and elitist. There's this idea of opera that it's just fat ladies in Viking helmets and shields and swords. Like, that's what I was expecting when I started working in the office, that I'd meet all these divas all of a sudden. And there's no one really like that at all. It's Wexford could have been that very exclusive, very elitist, very, like, reserved festival. Like, I mean, it could have just shut itself off from the community easily, because it had all this international support. But it never did. It never, like, lost sight of that community spirit. It never lost sight of the people around. And I think that's one of the great, great things about the festival.
And Joe Ryan told AB about his favourite story from the Opera Festival's long history.
An opera that was here just before my time, right, they had a Formica-type stage, right? And one of the things that we as a crew used to do to stop the artists from sliding down, we used to spray it with Lucozade to make it sticky, right? Like, it's like the slope was fairly severe, right? And unfortunately, we had all this set up the night before, sprayed it all nice and sticky. But what we didn't realise, that one of the cleaners came in the following morning, was walking and saw, that's very sticky, and wiped and mopped it all off, right? We knew nothing about it, right? So, start of the opera, soprano comes on, stands at the top, and next minute starts sliding down the stage. I said, oh, mother of divine God, what's going to happen now? And there's no way. She's getting towards the front edge of the orchestra pit, and next minute the lead comes on, ta-da, and starts sliding down the front of the stage again. I said, oh, mother of divine. So I think what really happened there is that I said, stop, everybody, curtain closed, spray as quick as you can, sticky, and back on again. Stick it. A red lemonade, anything with sprays to do it.
Joe Ryan with A.B. Philbin Bowman, and the festival opens next Wednesday. Full details on wexfordopera.com. Well, this week's Book on One was in tribute to the actor Susan Fitzgerald, who died recently. Susan worked frequently with RTE Radio, and listeners will remember her wonderful voice and her broad range as a performer. Here she is reading Emma Brown by Claire Boylan. And in this extract, the narrator Isabel, who's been married off to the much older Mr. Chalfont, reflects on the strangeness of marriage.
So, let us tackle this matter of marriage, this regulator of passions and property and population. For men, it may be a mere framework for their lives, but for women, it is the space within the frame that must be filled. Without any useful employment, this is akin to filling a leaky vessel with water. I was not in love with my husband, and therefore suspect that I was in the generality of women rather than the exception. I had not anticipated happiness, in consequence of which no disappointment lay in store. It was not the quality of marriage that dismayed me, but the quantity of it. Confined in close proximity to the plump and whiskery personage who considered me as much his property and as much for his usage as if I were his pipe or his slippers, I had need to remind myself that this shackling was not for a week or a year, nor for the number of years to which a criminal might be sentenced to bondage, but until one of us ran out of breath. My husband was as eager in application of his marital obligations as in his business activities, and I had to get used to his attentions. Discomfort seems to be the general lot of women, so I made my adjustments as best I could. Worst for me, and for many women, I suspect, was the lack of privacy for my head. As it had not occurred to my spouse that it currently owned any content, he took it upon himself to fill it all day and half the night with his own theories and opinions. In bed, he snored into my ear, and by day he talked into it. But all of this is commonplace, if generally unspoken. So where lay the surprise? The surprise was that in spite of such and so much strangeness, I remained unchanged.
The late and much missed Susan Fitzgerald, heard on the Book on One.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Well, there's been talk all week about austerity budgets and how to make ends meet. Well, maybe because of the recession. Home baking is, as they say, so hot right now. Over on Countrywide, Sinead Egan went to Galway's very own Bake Fest, where she met writer and baking enthusiast Lily Higgins.
I always think of baking as a hobby, you know, as a spare time thing. I mean, cooking is a necessity because you have to eat every day, but like, you don't need cake every day. Most people don't really need cake every day, but you know, it helps.
Can I ask, Lily, are there any Irish recipes that you like cooking? Like, say, like soda breads, or because we're not terribly well known for our baking.
Yeah, I know. Well, I suppose we're not exactly. We don't do like the French pastries and things like that. But I think that's because, like, if you look at us, we're not designed. We don't look like French pastry people anyway. I think we're real tea wrap people and soda breads. And one of my favourite things is Chester cake or Gur cake. You know, I was traditionally raised on that, and it's just you soak the bread or cake with tea, and then sultanas and loads of spices. And it's like a dense cake with a thick white icing on top, and in a pastry shell, and it's absolutely beautiful. So I think loads of traditional Irish foods, of baked foods, are all really made to keep us going. You know, there seems to be kind of a general theme of like, keep us warm, keep us going.
Yeah, because a little shoe pastry isn't going to get you anywhere, really, is
no,
it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think, you know, we come in from the fields picking potatoes and we're looking for an eclair, you know. I don't think that's the way we were. I don't think. Just want, like, a big, hot pot of tea, and you want soda bread, and you want, like, gooseberry jam or something, you know. I think that's, like, what we traditionally are going back to, what we were reared on, you know, and I think it's what works for us, you know.
Yeah, so true. So true.
Lily Higgins with Sinead Egan, heard on Countrywide. Well, Master Butcher Pat Whelan had more foodie tips on the Today Show. He comes from a long line of butchers going back 5 generations, and he was fascinating talking about his craft. Pat has just written a book with food writer Katie McGuinness. It's called The Irish Beef Book, and he talked recipes and cheap cuts with Sean O'Rourke yesterday.
Now, skirt steak is a phrase I suspect that may be new to a lot of our listeners.
There's a lot of talk about the lesser known or unknown cuts of beef that are sensational to taste, and skirt steak is one of them. But skirt is known in France as bavette, which a lot of listeners will probably know, and it's quite common on menus in France as bavette. But it tended to go into mince and stew in this country. But there's a whole new awakening around utilising this cut as a steak cut, which is fantastic value for money. But the most important thing about it is it's a particular flavour and a great taste sensation.
Does it have to be cooked very slowly?
Not at all. It's actually cooked quite quickly, but eaten directly off the pan, because it's one of those ones that slightly toughens after cooking, which is the unusual nature of the actual muscle. And it's from the belly of beef.
Right, so you've got this skirt steak with green herb sauce.
It's really, really simple to do. It's turned on the pan, it's left to rest, covered in foil, left to rest, and then sliced and shared.
It has to be literally from the pan to the plate. Okay, and I mean, how big would the portion be that you would buy if you're talking about buying a skirt steak?
You can buy it individually cut, or you can buy it in a piece. The piece itself could be a little over a kilo, trimmed, and then you can just portion it if you want, or you can actually cook the piece whole. In the recipe, it talks about cooking the piece whole, and it's kind of like a tear and share steak.
When you say it's good value, what kind of money are you talking about there?
Well, it would be half the price of regular steak cuts, so it's really... But the most important thing about it is it's a big taste sensation.
Sounds yum. Craft butcher Pat Whelan with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. Well, Tracy Pigott has carved out a very successful career as a horse racing commentator on RTÉ television. She's also the daughter of world-famous jockey Lester Pigott. And she spoke with Miriam O'Callaghan about her strategies for coping with anxiety and depression, a condition she believes first surfaced when she was sent away to boarding school at the age of 10.
You know, I suppose that's when I recognised, you know, that I would get sort of phases where I would feel very, very down, very, you know, no motivation and just very unhappy. And it continued on at different times in my life. And I think when you're younger, you're not really aware of what it is. You just don't know. You just kind of cope with it the best that you can. But I think there you develop certain characteristics that stick with you in your life and coping mechanisms and maybe putting, you know, armor on. So, yeah, I think probably that's when it started. And I think probably a lot of people would identify with the fact that it takes a long time to actually, first of all, recognize what it is, but also to accept that it's kind of part of who you are. I mean, I tried to fight it for so long and, oh, why am I like this? And, oh, this is, shouldn't be like this. But, you know, it is the way I'm made and learned then. And, you know, my mother's a great woman who has great wisdom. And you know, she always said, you know, when you accept the way you are, then you can work around it.
These days, Tracy practices mindfulness, a type of meditation. It's a way of living in the moment to calm the mind.
You know, my head would be spinning and scattered sort of thoughts all the time. And again, it would be really exhausting. And it's a way of kind of getting a bit of clarity, sort of trying to step away from all the mad thoughts in our heads. And I found by doing that, you actually do start to see things a little bit more clearly. And you can take that next step forward with a sense of clarity in your head, which I found very difficult because I was always sort of having 1,000 thoughts flying around.
So how does it practically work? Is it about living in the moment? I mean, when you say you get rid of all these other thoughts in your head to make it, well, like, how does it practically work?
Well, again, as I say, I'm just beginning into this and I've read a lot of those books. You know, I read The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, as I'm sure a lot of people have done. And, you know, it's really mad because we don't live in the moment. We're always, you know, well, I am. Anyway.
Thinking
I'm
ahead,
always thinking ahead. I've got to do this afternoon. Yeah. I've got to do this tonight. We're going to get tea for tea. And then tomorrow. And I might be on to next Wednesday. And the next thing, you know, you are completely not in yourself at that moment in time. So I think it makes an awful lot of sense to try and do that we can do nothing about what's happened. And God forbid, you know, we could be knocked down by a car in an hour's time. So we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And I would also find myself really, really worrying about things that were going to happen and almost have them, you know, playing out in my head like a television program that, you know, this is going to happen. And invariably, it never happens like that. So it's just, I suppose meditation scared me a lot. But then I found that thousands of people are doing it.
Tracy Pigott with Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday. Well, after 2 years of refurbishment, the Irish Museum of Modern Art, IMMA, finally reopened its doors last weekend at the Royal Hospital in Kilmainham. IMMA is hosting a major retrospective of the work of Irish designer Eileen Gray. Evelyn O'Rourke took a look back at the life and times of Eileen Gray for Wednesday night's Arena.
So where did the story of Eileen Gray begin? Well, the curator of this exhibition that started life in Paris is Chloe Pitu.
Eileen Gray was born in Enniscorthy.
She was born in 1878 in County Wexford.
Her mother was a lady, an aristocratic Scottish woman, and her father was a painter.
When did she start getting interested in painting and working herself?
It was just after a journey in Paris with her mother in 1900. It was a journey for the Exposition Universelle de Paris. And just after that, she decided to try in the Slade School of Fine Arts in London.
So by her early 20s, this youngest daughter of 5 children had set up home as an art student in London, and she would never reside in Ireland again. When her painter father died in 1900, shortly afterwards, Gray decided to move to Paris to continue her studies there. She worked carefully on developing her style, and it wasn't until 1913 that she finally felt confident enough to exhibit the pieces.
So I think the story of Eileen Gray is an evolution from the wax canvas to the space. She said, oh, I can do pieces of furniture. So she did some chairs or table. So she began decorator. And after that, when she realized that she could be an architect because she could design some spaces, she built a house.
And that house was the now acclaimed E1027, built on a steep cliff overlooking Monaco.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for Arena, and it's a brilliant exhibition, well worth the trip to IMMA. Well, I leave you now with the song from Sean Kane, who played live on the Today Show. Stay tuned for George Lee and the business. Garamahaga Vasur Golúther, Tasulam Gruanchev Saltasaglar, Nive Mishoncha on Chachtan Chahogin, Akbe Fiona Kelly, Rajanta, Gajian Chachtan and Yishin, Gajeshab Slan.
Fields of barley, you can tell the song in its jetty sky that we walk in fields of gold. So she took her love just 2 days a while upon the field.
fields of barley. In his arms she fell as her hair came down among the fields of gold. Will you stay with me? Will you be my love? Among the fields of barley, we forget the sun in his jetty sky as we lie in fields of gold. Feel that west wind move like a lover's soul upon the fields of barley. Feel her body rise when you kiss her mouth among the fields of gold. I never made promises lightly, and there have been some that I've broken, and I swear in the days still left we'd walk in fields of gold. Yes, we'd walk in fields.